Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beats. I personally take Super Beats when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Super Beats gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at intelligentbeats.com. That's intelligentbeats.com. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we are continuing with this week's questions. With me is Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. And Layla, what's next?
This comes from Arlene, and she asks, what is the best number for blood sugar? I love this question because I actually answered it in a recent newsletter.
Okay.
For us, but that's a very, very broad question. What is the best blood sugar? We have to give it some context first. I'm assuming that Arlene means fasting blood sugar, because blood sugar will vary whether you're fasting or after a meal, whether it's 1 hour, whether it's 2 or 3 hours after a meal. So the best blood sugar, Dr. Hoffman, you and I know that a lab value or the reference range is anywhere maybe between 60 and 100 milligrams per deciliter for blood sugar,
right?
Or so, right? And
yep.
Normally, though, we find anything in the upper end of normal, say 90 or above, to be questionable. That person may have some, blood sugar issues, pre-diabetes, possibly diabetes. Oftentimes, we see many patients come in with a fasting blood sugar in the normal range. But we uncover that either they have metabolic syndrome, prediabetes, diabetes, because their blood sugars will go higher with a glucose challenge. So what am I really saying? A fasting blood sugar doesn't give us enough information.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not a dynamic reading, and we actually want to observe the behavior of the sugar response in relationship to a challenge some kind of carbohydrate loading. And then we can see, does the blood sugar it's going to go up. Does it go up normally? And then does it bottom out with with reactive hypoglycemia? What happens to the blood sugar under normal physiologic conditions? And here's a couple of problems. One is that you can get difficulties with blood that sits around for too long will sometimes give you a spurious low value.
Huh.
You'll actually see the blood sugar have a value that is lower than what it really is, because sitting around too long, there's something that spoils the reading.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like the sugar gets used up in the metabolism of the red blood cells while they remain alive in the test tube.
There's also a
problem with, people say they're fasting, but are they really fasting?
Mm-hmm. My mother, when she goes to see her cardiologist, says, oh, it's okay. Do I need to come in fasting? Yes, but you could have a cup of coffee in the morning.
And so what's with a cup of coffee? Well, what's with it? I mean, is it black? Is it with milk? Is it with, sugar?
The caffeine alone, I believe, is still going to cause an abnormal rise in blood sugar for many people.
Yes,
it
will.
Not everyone, but for some.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it can still skew that result. So.
Well, the reason you give the people the opportunity to have some coffee is because you don't want a super cranky patient who's got a splitting headache come into your office. So, that's, I think, the rationale for that. And we like our patients to be coherent when they come for their first visit. We tell them, don't bother fasting. If you need a fasting blood test, we'll work it out later. We want you to be able to talk. And, if you need that cup of coffee in the morning, please have your cup of coffee so that you can actually have a conversation with us. And,
have a good breakfast, too, because we have lots of information to disseminate to you when you come in.
Absolutely. We want you to be able to focus. Okay, so what's our next question, please?
Oh, our next question is from John.
Mm-hmm.
My nephew has Brugada syndrome. He has an implanted defibrillator and pacemaker.
Isn't that a really fancy hotel in Las Vegas, casino, the Brugada? The Brugada. They have like marble statues, like replicas of the David and the... No, that's not the Brugada. That's something...
No, that's not the Brugada.
Okay. It's, right.
So, Brugada syndrome is hereditary. It causes sudden, unexpected cardiac death in apparently healthy individuals.
Hmm.
And when I looked at the stats, Dr. Hoffman, 4 to 12% incidence.
So it's actually a pretty common syndrome. I must admit that, I got to say, I'm not familiar with that syndrome, but I understand what it is. It's unpredictable cardiac arrhythmias that can literally lead to sudden cardiac death, perhaps ventricular tachycardia, which is dangerous. So what's the question?
Is there anything he could do nutritionally to support his condition?
Well, the first thing...
despite the defibrillator and the pacemaker, which can only help...
Okay, so here's the deal. It's really... This is interesting what they do, and this is a medical marvel. You get two things. You get a defibrillator because it actually shocks you. This is actually what... I don't know whether he still has this. He probably still does. Cheney had one of these things in his chest because it actually delivers electrical shock to your heart if your heart should go into ventricular tachycardia. So it resuscitates you automatically so that there's no pause, while somebody goes to find a resuscitation device if you should have a drop attack and a sudden cardiac arrhythmia, which could lead to sudden death within minutes. So anyway, you have this implantable thing, and it could go off at any moment's notice. That's kind of a scary thing, but it's life-saving. And then you also have a pacemaker. So the pacemaker keeps your heart from going too slow. The defibrillator keeps your heart from going too fast, so you're covered. So that's covered both ways. Is this something natural? Well, some studies suggest you really don't want your defibrillator to go off because that's unpleasant. So what can you do? Well, you can take magnesium. And you can take an absorbable form of magnesium, like magnesium taurate or perhaps jigsaw magnesium. You can also take omega-3 fatty acids. There are actually studies that show that omega-3 fatty acids reduce the incidence of fatal cardiac arrhythmias. So omega-3s are good. Many patients with these types of problems may be on blood thinners, but still okay to take fish oil. And also, the full complement of coenzyme Q10, perhaps carnitine, perhaps ribose, nutrients that are supportive to the heart muscle. Those are the things that I think would be beneficial primarily.
I would imagine avoiding situations that would cause palpitation things.
Don't go to the Halloween parade. Don't go to the House of Horrors. Avoid hypoglycemia. That's a very important one.
Skip a meal if you're going to start to feel shaky.
Avoid that double mocha latte with a shot. Whatever they call them. Those fancy highly caffeinated drinks at Starbucks. Mm-hmm. That would make sense. And those are some of the things. And I actually would suggest, not heavy-duty physical exertion, but mild cardiac exertion to condition the heart, which can have a regularizing effect on heart rhythm. Not doing sprints or, trying to do 60 push-ups at a time, but maybe, some walking and, maybe some pool exercises that are moderate in intensity. Mm-hmm. That would be good.
Okay. Thank you for your question, John.
Yeah.
Next is from Rachel. I once heard Dr. Hoffman say that we need some H. pylori in our system.
Hmm.
I was treated for that after an endoscopy for stomach pain with the usual drugs a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I did some additional blood work showing I'm producing H. pylori antibodies.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything I need to be concerned with or treat?
Well,
Thanks so much. Love the show.
Okay, so here's the deal. With H. pylori, as we've so often reiterated, H. pylori lives in the stomach, and its presence is associated with a higher risk of stomach ulcers and gastritis. However, and doctors tend to, as a result of that, they'll test people for it, and they'll eradicate it whenever it's present, because there is, admittedly, there's a slightly higher risk of stomach cancer with H. pylori, but that risk is tiny anyway.
Okay.
But the result of our campaign to eradicate H. pylori with what are called triple antibiotics along with acid-blocking medications. One medication is a combo called PrevPac, is that we, increase the likelihood of lower gastrointestinal problems because we damage the balance of flora in the intestinal tract. We promote yeast and bad bacteria. And B, it turns out that the presence of H. pylori, while increasing the risk of stomach problems, it actually is protective against esophageal problems. So you may trade a stomach problem for GERD or heartburn or reflux. And so therefore, you know, unless you actually have an ulcer that's really not healing or you have gastritis, I don't think there's good reason to try to eradicate H. pylori. Mm-hmm.
I saw a case recently of a woman. All of her problems started when she was given that triple antibiotic therapy.
Yeah, Prevpac. Mm-hmm.
For the H. pylori, and now she is chronically hoarse. She's uncomfortable.
Ah. Well, the hoarseness comes from the GERD, the esophageal reflux.
Yeah.
Okay. So. Oh, well. All right. So, and by the way, the antibody test, it'll remain positive. Just as, you know, if we test you, when you were a kid, you had the mumps, and you get tested for the mumps, you'll have antibodies to the mumps. That means your body has created protective antibodies, but it doesn't mean you still have the mumps. And similarly with H. pylori, the antibody test only reveals that you had an encounter with it in the past. It doesn't tell you whether you still have it. Antibodies tend to decline over time, but they don't often go away completely. The best way to test for H. pylori was with a breath test. It's a urea breath test, it's a byproduct of metabolism of H. pylori, and it actually can tell you if you have it. Or alternatively, when they look down there, they can use a special stain when they take a sample from the lining of your stomach to see if H. pylori is there. That's the way they establish the diagnosis.
Okay. A lot of people apparently don't know they have H. pylori because it's not...
It's asymptomatic. It's the vast, vast, vast majority of people, it's asymptomatic. It doesn't need to be eradicated. There's some natural treatments for it. I believe cranberry has...
Mastic gum.
Yeah, cranberry. There's a product called Zinc Lori, which is zinc carnosine, which seems to, it soothes the stomach, but it also seems to go after the H. pylori. Probiotics, you know, they're actually quite... olive leaf, I believe, has some action against H. pylori. So there's some ways of getting rid of it without powerful antibiotics, in my opinion.
Okay. Best of luck to Rachel.
Yep.
All right. We have a question from Linda. Hi, I have a question about Graves' disease. I'd like to know if it's safe to take a multivitamin with iodine if you have a family history of Graves' disease. I've been finding conflicting information about this. Any advice is appreciated.
Right.
The amount of iodine in the multi,
exactly.
I don't think is any big deal.
Exactly.
I think it's about 150 micrograms, typically.
The controversy might come up where there are some studies that suggest that if you administer high doses of iodine to people who have a predisposition to Graves. By the way, what Graves is, it's an autoimmune disease, but it's hyperthyroidism. It's where the thyroid is too active, and it's almost like you've taken speed. You know, your heart speeds up, you get a big appetite, but you continually lose weight, your hands start to shake. And I've actually talked to some patients with Graves, and it's tough to keep up with them because they are real chatterboxes sometimes, and they're distressed and anxious and hyper. And ultimately, this can be damaging to the heart, and it can be damaging to the bone. So you have to slow down the thyroid under those circumstances.
There is that side effect of the bulging eyes where
that
fat
too.
Accumulates behind the eyeball.
Yes, that is, yeah,
so
it's associated
that
with that.
Constant surprised look or
bulging eyes
might be a clue, right?
So there are some studies that show that if you administer high doses of iodine to people who have a predisposition to this, that they will go hyper. It'll make them go more hyper. Iodine is actually a cofactor.
It's adding fuel to the fire.
It's adding fuel to the fire.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are advocates of using iodine to suppress the thyroid. It's high doses, but I think that's tricky because it could go either way. You could either suppress it or you could set it off. So I haven't used high dose iodine therapy in my practice. I feel a little uncomfortable doing that in patients with active Graves' disease. Radioactive iodine, however, is used for that condition to zap the thyroid.
Yeah, but I would still imagine, though, for Linda, taking a multi with iodine is probably okay.
Yeah, exactly. That's
with
her question.
With a family history of Graves, she doesn't necessarily have Graves.
Right.
Is what
right.
I'm getting from this message.
Yep.
But I would think.
By the way, what's interesting, patients who have family history of Graves, it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's going to get Graves. It seems that sometimes there's a family history of thyroid problems. One person may have hyper, another may have hypo, because hyper and hypo, although they're the opposite, are kind of related. They are both related to a sick thyroid condition. And so we'll, if we look through the family tree, we'll see one person with Graves, one person with Hashimoto's, which is a low thyroid condition. And thyroid problems may run in the family. I'm not sure if Graves is going to run in the family. When I see a lot of people with Graves, I think of maybe some kind of common exposure to, some kind of toxin or some harmful agent. Curiously, during the presidency of George H. Bush, the dad, the older Bush, the elder, both he and Barbara had hyperthyroidism. That's kind of weird.
Wow.
And I think the dog had hyperthyroidism, too.
The dog?
Yeah. What were they putting in the water in the White House? What was going on there? Were they like,
wow.
Oh, man, maybe they had microwave radiation from the Soviet embassy focused on the White House. Goodness. Who knows? I mean, something was going on there that everybody seemed to come down with it.
Wow. Okay, Linda, we hope that helps you.
Yep.
All right. This message comes from Eric. Dr. Hoffman, my father has bladder cancer and will be treated with BCG, which is Bacillus Calmette-Guerin.
Mm-hmm.
Are there certain foods that should be avoided, encouraged? Are there any supplements?
Well, I think I may have answered this on our radio program on Saturday, but nonetheless, I'll answer it. I think bladder cancer, especially this is a milder form of bladder cancer. This is one of the conditions where they actually use a bacteria to stimulate the immunity of the bladder wall. It's a very old-fashioned treatment, and it's actually one of the few cancers where that seems to work. There was a cancer practitioner named Virginia Livingston back in the 70s, 80s, perhaps into the 90s, and she used BCG on virtually every form of cancer, believing that it could be helpful, but I think it may only be helpful in bladder cancer. It stimulates the immunity, and I think bladder cancer is an ideal cancer for nutritional intervention, because think of it, they talk about, when you take vitamins, you just make expensive urine. Well, in this case, if you make expensive urine, it sits in your bladder and it bathes the bladder wall, and that would be good. So if you're taking nutrients that are anti-cancer, like curcumin and EGCG and vitamin D and C and selenium, PhytoGuard, which combines some of these plant extracts, HCC, which is an immune enhancing mushroom extract. All these things, if they sit in the bladder literally, until you discharge them from the body in the urine stream. And this would be an ideal case for nutritional intervention. In fact, even intravenous vitamin C, because then you could achieve very, very high concentrations of vitamin C in the bladder. And that would penetrate to the cells lining the bladder, which is what's at issue here, because this is a superficial cancer. Obviously, it's not penetrated the bladder wall or gone outside of the bladder. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they'd be removing the bladder or they'd be using chemo or radiation. Mm-hmm. So, as I answered pretty much the same answer I gave on the Saturday show, that I think the nutritional intervention could be very helpful. Yeah. And, just a caveat about cancer. When we talk cancer, we have to be very, very, we have to be very careful in our recommendations because, there are many different types of cancer. There are different stages of cancer. There's no generic, one-size-fits-all treatment for cancer. And sometimes when people are getting conventional therapies like chemo or radiation, there are contraindications. You don't want to get in the way of the efficacy of the conventional treatment. Otherwise, why bother doing it? And we have to look very carefully. And that's why I'm a little reluctant to answer questions about cancer in this program because we want to know, we spend a lot of time with each cancer patient at the Hoffman Center, and we want to know precisely what conventional treatment they're getting, what exact type of cancer they have, what stage of cancer it is, and we may want to test them for levels of various, key nutrients that have an impact.
Yeah. Oh, best of luck, Eric. Okay. We have a question from Diana. I had my thyroid removed in 2009 because of large nodules. Mm-hmm. My question is, my hair continues to fall out. I'm taking Armour Thyroid, I'm taking biotin.
When did she have her thyroid removed?
2009.
2009, okay.
Because of large nodules she had removed.
Okay.
Her hair is continuing to fall out. despite taking armothyroid biotin, like 5,000 micrograms of biotin, which is the right amount to take, saw palmetto, vitamin E, vitamin D, etc., all of these. But my hair continues to fall out.
Do you have any easy questions for us this
Well, wait. This might have an easy answer.
Okay, because we...
to get her thyroid rechecked, she might need a higher dose of armor, don't you think?
Yeah, that's possible. Look, she's doing a lot of the right things. Clearly hair growth has a lot of components, and it's not just a matter of, I sometimes refer to what's called the miracle grow theory of hair loss, is that hair loss is not just about, taking the right nutrients to grow hair. So there are other factors involved, like your thyroid function, menopause, malabsorption, autoimmunity. And so
low iron or low ferritin.
Absolutely. These are other factors that need to be investigated. So we'd have to take a look.
Yeah.
All right. That's about all the time that we have for today's edition of Q&A with Layla. And we're happy to take your questions. So send them to us at radioprogram@AOL.com. And we'll endeavor to answer as many of them as we can, if they're suitable. I want to thank you, Layla, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
My pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for listening. And this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.